loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, if the mainstream media is to be believed, Russian intelligence services, hackers, and internet trolls manipulated social media in 2016, while employees of the Trump campaign colluded with Russian spies to give the country Donald Trump as president. But in an exhaustive new article in Consortium News, Gareth Porter says that narrative simply isn't true. He says that a report done by the New York Times, which is cited as the definitive piece on this issue, is fundamentally flawed and journalistically irresponsible. Next, Andrew Brunson, an American pastor who has been held by Turkish authorities for 2 years on terrorism charges, which he has steadfastly denied, was convicted in a Turkish court today, but then immediately sentenced to time served and released. He left Turkey. Meanwhile, Turkish authorities investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi told the Washington Post that they have video and audio evidence of Khashoggi being detained, tortured, murdered, and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate. Then Syrian rebels appear to be complying with an agreement with Turkey and Russia to withdraw heavy weapons from Idlib and the buffer zone along the Turkish border. The Free Syrian Army already has confirmed that it has withdrawn all tanks and heavy guns from Idlib, the last rebel-held bastion in Syria. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn once again to the Russiagate story. If the corporate-owned mainstream media is to be believed, Russian intelligence services, hackers, and internet trolls manipulated social media in 2016, while employees of the Trump campaign colluded with Russian spies to give the country Donald Trump as president. But in an exhaustive new article in Consortium News, Gareth Porter says that narrative simply isn't true. He says that a report done by the New York Times, which is cited as the definitive piece on the issue, is fundamentally flawed and journalistically irresponsible. We're joined here in our studio by Gareth Porter. Gareth is a historian. He's an investigative journalist, an analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy, and he is the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Gareth Porter, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Brian. Glad to be back.
We are very happy that you were able to join us. You know, Gareth, we've done this story, of course, because we're Sputnik, so we've followed the Russiagate story more than we want to.
We've been
in and out and all around with this story. But I have to tell you, and I want our audience to know, that the piece that you've done at Consortium News is a remarkably strong contribution to this discussion, a discussion that needs to happen. And I have to say, when we use the adjective exhaustive about your report, you must be exhausted, because it really is, it's like top-notch journalism. You delve into very complicated numbers to try to dissect and help us understand what actually happened. Let's start with the big question. Did the Russian interference, as proclaimed in the New York Times article and by others, did it have an impact or a significant impact, if in fact it's true, on the 2016 election?
My answer is unequivocally no. I mean, it was just too tiny in relation to the entire social media output or content, as they like to say, to have any significant impact. I mean, the numbers that Facebook and Twitter have themselves put out are clear indications of that. And if you go a little bit deeper, you find that even their numbers don't quite plumb the true insignificance, if you will, of the contribution that was made to the total election-related content by either the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, or the mysterious 50,000 accounts which Twitter has said that they regard as, quote, Russia-related or associated with Russia. And I'll come back to that, I'm sure, in our conversation later. But basically, the point that I'm making here is that if you look at the actual figures that Twitter and Facebook have put out and go to the basic reality that they reflect, you simply cannot believe that there was any significant impact on this election.
We talk about that with some frequency here, actually. We talk about the money that was expended on Facebook ads. It was something like $100,000, $50,000 of which was spent after the election was over. At least $25,000 of the remaining $50,000 was spent in states that were solidly blue or solidly red. So what was the goal then?
And you're talking about the Internet Research Agency, IRA, which is a private corporation.
Correct. Outside of St. Petersburg, Russia. What was the point, if not to somehow influence the election? Why would they spend a measly $25,000, which I can tell you as a CIA officer was less than what my monthly petty cash was?
Right. Well, I mean, look, this is a mystery that needs to be addressed clearly. I didn't try to do that in my piece. It lies a little bit outside that. But, you know, I mean, it has been argued that essentially this Internet Research Agency is a commercial outfit, that their political efforts, their election-related efforts were somehow related to the fundamental aim of trying to get more people to buy their ads and to make money. Now, you know, I'm not taking a position on that. I haven't delved into it sufficiently to try to resolve that question. All I know is that if they were trying to affect the election, and I'm not trying to make the argument that they weren't at this point, but if they were trying to affect the election, it was a pathetically small effort and clearly did not have any impact that one could identify.
Gareth Porter is our guest. He's written a really, really important article. I want people to go to consortiumnews.com and read this article. It's called "The Shaky Case That Russia Manipulated Social Media to Tip the 2016 Election." Gareth Porter is an investigative journalist, a historian, and author. Impeccable credentials as an independent journalist with a fantastic knowledge and an immense sort of objective faculty, so that he's able to discern and dissect news in a way that doesn't start with a preconceived political outcome. Right, Gareth? I mean, you're not trying to sort of come, I mean, you're not even actually taking a position here on whether Russia or Russians or the Russian government tried to do something in the 2016 election. That's not your point. What you're really dealing with was, even assuming that was the case, whatever the Facebook interactions were by the Internet Research Agency, that they were so measly, so small, so ineffective, so lacking a particularized target, that they could not have had the impact that the New York Times article says they did have.
Yeah, and it does seem to me to reflect the reality that whatever the thinking was in the Kremlin, that they were not going all out to use social media to try to influence the election. Now, you know, the question of hacking of the DNC and what they may have done with the emails is another question entirely, which I don't want to get into today, but I think one has to set that aside for the moment in order to be clear about this question of the use of social media.
I want to read, Gareth, a little bit from your article on Consortium News and then have you comment. And the subtitle in this part is called "A Theoretical Possibility." What Facebook General Counsel Colin Stretch actually said in testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee last October was quite different from what the New York Times reporters claimed. Quote, "Our best estimate is that approximately 126 million people may have been served one of these IRA-generated stories at some time during the two-year period," close quote, Stretch said. That's to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Then you write, Gareth, Stretch was expressing a theoretical possibility rather than an established accomplishment. Facebook was saying that an estimated 126 million Facebook members might have gotten at least one story from the IRA, not over the 10-week election period, but over 194 weeks during the 2 years 2015 through 2017. That figure, in turn, was based on the estimate that 29 million people might have gotten at least one story in their Facebook feed over that same 2 year period, and on the assumption that they shared it with others at a particular rate. Those are powerful, powerful numbers, actually, because I know as a Facebook user, I read like a small percentage of the articles coming across in my newsfeed. So if I might have gotten one in 194 weeks from the IRA, I might have missed that.
Right.
That's exactly the point. Yes. Well, thank you for not summarizing, but basically reading the key part of this article that relates to Facebook. And just to add to what you've just said, to put an exclamation point on it, Facebook itself actually has reported officially in their own blogs that, in fact, they found that only 1 out of 10 of the content that is put into Facebook news feeds is actually seen by anybody. So
yeah, that makes sense.
So
yeah,
one has to discount the figures that Facebook put out. And by the way, that's discounting the 29 million people by at least a factor of 10 in terms of anybody actually having seen any of that. So that's the beginning point for assessing the whole impact question with regard to Facebook. And I think, you know, it does in fact add up to a very small impact. And I think that one has to begin with the idea that Facebook was really not aware of any real impact and was saying that in their own testimony. I mean, they're really discounting it in their own testimony.
Yeah. You know, when one thing that's important, I think, for our audience to also realize that there's basically a couple lines to the story. One was Facebook and Twitter were manipulated by Russia and providing false advertising to particularize groups to sow social division in the country to accomplish something. Perhaps they have a hard time making a direct connection to the Donald Trump campaign because most of the ads don't talk about Trump or Clinton. They're just about social issues.
Let me just add one more point, Brian, which I have to have my own cheat sheet here to remember all the key numbers because there's so many of them. But Facebook itself has said that the content coming from the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, accounts for only 0.0004% of the total content. And that is an astounding number.
I want to read part of your story again this is Gareth Porter. We want people to go to Consortium News and read his story. I want to read that paragraph that has that 0.0004%. That's 0.004%. I can't even say that. 0.004%.
And I got confused about it myself because it's so small.
Okay, here's the paragraph. The first problem with citing those figures, these are the figures that the Times cited, as evidence of impact on the 2016 election is that Facebook did not claim that all or even most of the 80,000 IRA, that's the Internet Research Agency posts, were election related. It offered no data on what proportion of the feeds to those 29 million people was, in fact, election related. But Stretch, he's the general counsel for Facebook, did testify that IRA content over that 2 year period, that's the 194 weeks, not 10 weeks before the election, represented just 0.004%, that's 0.0004% of the total content of Facebook news feeds. Gareth Porter, you have done a remarkable service. If people go to this article and just use it as the reference, because we have to keep talking about it with our friends because it keeps coming up in the mainstream media. And at a certain point, people get lost in all of this. Your eyes start to glaze over. And here are the facts. You have taken the time to actually break down the facts. I was starting to say a moment ago, there's another fact. You know, remember Twitter said that they would no longer provide any more advertising for Sputnik, for this station, after these revelations. And guess what? We never took out an ad for Twitter. Not one. And Twitter did offer, though, RT a whole 2016 election package. They said, we'll help you spread RT's influence in its coverage of the 2016 election campaign. That was before the election. And RT said no because Twitter's offer was...
One word, politics.
That's what it is.
It's politics. It's politics, and it's a politics that doesn't stop. You know, one thing is the article that you have taken the time to debunk in the New York Times, the title of it is The Plot to Subvert an Election, Unraveling the Russian Story So Far. It sounds so...
Sinister, I believe is the
sinister.
Word.
Sinister. Yeah. It looks sinister. Putin is coming out like a demon out of this graphic, out of Trump's head, actually. Oh, my goodness. It's sinister, but it also looks like the definitive work. It looks like, here we go. Now we're filling in all the blanks.
That's right. It is sold as that. And indeed, the New York Times correspondent, Scott Shane and Mark Mazzetti, the whole tone of the thing certainly carries through that conceit that they are, in fact, giving us the ultimate story, a storyline about this election. And so I think it's particularly irresponsible and sinister of them to have so played tricks with the reading public about these figures that they use. And of course, it's possible that they glanced at the headlines that the New York Times itself used in its own coverage and never bothered to look further. And I suspect that that's the case. But that in itself, to my mind, is a damning indictment of their coverage. And by the way, when we get to Twitter, which we haven't talked about, a key point in the storyline that I basically cover in my story that nobody else has is that there is a huge market for many of them fake accounts, but accounts that are dead, that are sold, bought and sold by the tens and hundreds of thousands, much of which takes place in Russia. And that is a key part of the storyline, clearly, in my view, which helps to explain a large part.
Let me just ask you. So that's taking place in Russia regardless of 2016 or regardless of an election cycle, or
That's right. This is separate from the election cycle, but of course it's relevant to it. And Scott Shane reported the existence of this huge market in Russia in a story in September 2017. So he knows about it, but it doesn't show up at all. There's no relationship in his mind, apparently, between that and the story that he wrote last month.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Twitter. Again, Gareth Porter is our guest. Gareth has written an article that you can find on Consortium News. It's the shaky case that Russia manipulated social media to tip the 2016 elections. Again, I want to read to you, Gareth, from your own article and then have you comment on it. Shane and Mazzetti, those are the Times reporters, treatment of the role of Twitter in the alleged Russian involvement in the election focuses on 3,814 Twitter accounts said to be associated with the IRA, which supposedly interacted, quote, with 1.4 million Americans, close quote. Although that number looks impressive, without any further explanation, more disaggregated data provides a different picture. More than 90% of the tweets from the IRA had nothing to do with the election. 90% of those.
90%.
And those that did were infinitesimally few in relation to the entire Twitter stream relating to the 2016 campaign. Twitter's, again, I'm quoting Gareth Porter's article, Twitter's own figures show that those 3,814 IRA-linked accounts posted 175,993 tweets during the 10 weeks of the election campaign, but that only 8.4% of the total number of IRA-generated tweets were actually election-related.
Right. So again, you have to begin by sort of deflating the figures that Shane and Mazzetti used to impress the public with the idea that 1.4 million Americans were being interacted with by the Russians in the election campaign period. This, in this case, it is the 10 weeks of the election, by 90% automatically. And so, I mean, again, this reflects the failure of the New York Times correspondents to really deal with reality here.
Can I interrupt you on that point, Gareth?
Yes.
There's a pattern here as well, especially as it relates to Scott Shane. Mark Mazzetti, a little less so because he's so much younger. But Scott Shane has done this kind of thing over the years where he'll take a political position and then just search for the information necessary to support his own political position or the narrative of the New York Times. I think this is one of those cases.
There's no doubt about it. Yeah. And I mean, he's a dyed-in-the-wool New York Times reporter, which means that he accepts the basic practices
exactly.
of the big media in regard to sensitive national security issues. That doesn't mean that he hasn't written good stories.
Sure,
he has.
Sure.
He has done some good stories. But there are boundaries that he does not cross, and there are basic tropes that he will automatically be inclined to follow. And he
Precisely.
Has blinders on with regard to those things. So we're not talking about a conspiracy here. We're talking about the basic way in which big media operates, at least in my view.
You know, I'm looking at the website Wired,
yes.
which talks about all things technology-wise and social media. There's an article. It's from February 23rd, 2018. The title of the article is How Trump Conquered Facebook Without Russian Ads. Why Russia's Facebook ads were less important to Trump's victory than his own Facebook ads. That's also an important part of this. And this article, which is written by somebody who actually developed the customs audience system for Facebook that allows for targeting of specialized ads. This person actually developed it. Now he wrote this article. He shows how the Trump administration completely undid Hillary Clinton in terms of the use of social media. They spent, I think, about $90 million on social media altogether. Trump did in 2016. Unlike, what was the number for the IRA? 100?
10,000, I think. I thought it was, yeah.
And they spent $90 million. But it also shows that they were able to use and manipulate in a legal way, the sophisticated use of Facebook in particular, so that people were, especially in states like in the battleground states, their news feeds were getting bombarded in the last days before the election with Trump campaign Facebook messaging. And it was all kinds of different things to black voters. It was messaging about how Hillary Clinton had called young black men or some young black men super predators. To Bernie supporters on Facebook, it was about how Hillary Clinton had stolen the election. Those were things designed to suppress voter turnout. They were very effective. And in this article in Wired, it says, in essence, Clinton was paying Manhattan prices for the square footage on your smartphone screen while Trump was paying Detroit prices, meaning they game the system properly. Facebook users in swing states who felt Trump had taken over their news feeds may not have been hallucinating. I mean, that's an important part of the story.
Well, and this relates to the final part of my piece, which is the mysterious 50,000 so-called Russia-linked or Russia-associated Twitter accounts. And what I figured out by sort of following these numbers back to their origin, the 50,000 accounts, half of which were automated, in fact, clearly are related to accounts that were masked. The origin, the geographical origin of the accounts are masked, as Twitter themselves reported. And clearly, these were accounts primarily that had been taken over by the Trump campaign. Overwhelmingly, they overwhelmed Hillary Clinton in that regard. And the figures that I have here show that Hillary Clinton actually got 0.62% of her likes and 0.55% of her retweets from the automated accounts that were regarded as Russia-linked. And at the same time, Trump got several times that many. So this indicates that those Russia-linked accounts, quote-unquote, that were being talked about by Shane and Mazzetti were actually automated bots accounts that were owned by the Trump and Clinton campaigns.
Really, really something. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been speaking with Gareth Porter. His new article is The Shaky Case That Russia Manipulated Social Media to Tip the 2016 Election. You can read that at Consortium News. Gareth Porter is a historian. He's an investigative journalist and an analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. He is the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Andrew Brunson, an American pastor who has been held by Turkish authorities for 2 years on terrorism charges, which he's steadfastly denied, was convicted in a Turkish court today, but then immediately sentenced to time served and released. He left Turkey immediately. Meanwhile, Turkish authorities investigating the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi told the Washington Post that they have video and audio evidence of Khashoggi being detained, tortured, murdered, and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Gunal Tol, the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor and has taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. Welcome, Dr. Tol.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Andrew Brunson first. This has been the single major sticking point in bilateral relations between the United States and Turkey. And it seems like this was a face-saving way for both sides to get what they wanted. For the Turkish side, there's a conviction. For the American side, Mr. Brunson's on his way home. Is that how you see it?
Well, partly. I think the way and the manner in which the last hearing was handled, I think proved once again that this was a sham trial. Because throughout the entire trial, the court heavily relied on secret witnesses. And at the last minute today, those secret witnesses retracted their testimonies against Mr. Brunson. And also, just yesterday, we heard from American media, which is very likely to be true, that the deal was cut between Turkish and American side. And I also was expecting, and I had told that several times, that I was expecting Andrew Brunson to be released today, because there are so many outstanding issues on the agenda. And Brunson case was the easiest issue that the Turkish side could compromise on. So I think that is the key takeaway. The takeaway is that it just shows once again the sorry state of rule of law in Turkey and how President Erdogan holds Western citizens as hostages. I think that's number one. And number two, I think another important takeaway is that playing hardball with President Erdogan pays off. Because the American side has been holding talks with the Turkish side for over a year now. And in the summer, in July, that's when Andrew Brunson appeared in court. Reportedly, the American side gave concessions to the Turkish side. And yet, it was not enough for the Turkish side, so Brunson was kept in jail. Only after the U.S. administration decided to slap sanctions on two Turkish officials that President Erdogan decided to release him. So in a way, yes, this was a face-saving way of releasing him because he was convicted. But on the other hand, it's also, again, it says something about the state of affairs, the state of rule of law and human rights in Turkey. He was convicted. And yet he was released saying that he already served his time. But there are thousands of people in Turkey who are facing long-term prison sentences on similar charges. And yet Andrew Brunson was released. He was convicted, but he was still released, which is very welcome news, by the way. But it just tells you how political the judicial process has been in Turkey.
That's a good point. There are thousands of people incarcerated in Turkey who have not been formally charged with crimes yet, but have been accused of being supporters of Fethullah Gulen or having been supportive of or participated in the attempted coup a couple of summers ago. This is a very good point that Dr. Toll is raising, that Andrew Brunson got his trial and was convicted on a terrorism charge, but that was deemed to be, you know, an appropriate length of time, 2 years on terrorism. It doesn't make any sense.
It's clearly pure politics.
It really is.
Dr. Toll, let's talk about the other issue that's unfolding, and not just what actually happened at the Saudi consulate and what might happen between Turkish and Saudi relations, but this also seems perhaps to be another page or perhaps even another chapter in U.S.-Turkish relations, especially as the Turkish government says it has audio and video, which documents and proves that this man was tortured and killed, which would mean, of course, that they were surveilling the Saudi consulate. But here in the United States, there's a rising crescendo of opposition voices one never, ever hears against Saudi Arabia, but we're hearing them now. Talk about that a little bit.
That's right. It's a very difficult situation. The Trump administration is in a very difficult spot because the administration has built its entire Middle Eastern strategy on the Saudis, because their number one aim in the region is curbing the Iranian influence, and they think that the Saudis can deliver that. And also there is the question of rising oil prices, and there is the upcoming Iran sanction, which will cause even more price spikes. So that's a very important issue, and the Trump administration clearly signaled that they're not really willing to punish the Saudis or break the ties. So when that is the case, what's making this interesting in terms of Turkey-U.S. relations is the fact that Turkish officials have been leaking information to the Western media, arguing that they have hard proof of the killing. And right now, I think American officials are in Turkey helping Turkish officials with the investigation, and so are the Saudi officials. So and just to give you the context, this is a very difficult spot to be in for President Erdogan as well, because despite all the tension between Saudi and Turkey, President Erdogan stayed clear of criticizing the Saudi leadership directly. And now he cannot do that because all eyes are on him now. So he has to make a decision. Is he going to disclose the information that he says he has, or will he look the other way, just like he's done in the past? So that's why now I don't know if this entire Khashoggi incident has factored into the negotiations between Turkey and the United States, because clearly I think the Trump administration would have liked to avoid this, but it would be very difficult for the Trump administration to avoid if President Erdogan decides to disclose that evidence. So that's why I think there could be an interesting twist there with the Khashoggi incident in Turkey-U.S. relations.
Yeah, I think so, too.
There was a very interesting point. Well, it was a point to me. I think most Americans didn't really focus on it. But this cooperation between the Turks and outside law enforcement organizations took the form of an admission that the Turks have video and audio evidence of Khashoggi being killed. Well, that's an admission. And I'm saying this as a former intelligence officer. That's an admission that they have video and audio coverage inside the Saudi consulate. That's a very, very bold thing to say. You're essentially admitting that you're spying on an ally. Now, of course, that happens every day, but countries usually don't talk about it. How do you think that'll affect relations between the two countries?
Well, I think it's already very tense. The Saudis, I mean, Erdogan and the ruling party in Turkey, they've been very concerned about what the Saudis are doing in Syria. There's been widespread, the media, especially the pro-government media, has been covering the story of Saudi officials meeting with top PKK officials, which is considered a terrorist organization by Turkey, in Syria. And yet, President Erdogan has been mute on that. But there are just so many problems already facing Turkey-Saudi relations. And I think that's the reason why there is now growing pressure on President Erdogan to do something to hold the Saudis accountable. But whether he will choose to do so remains to be seen. But this is a very difficult time for President Erdogan, because he really doesn't want to alienate the Saudis completely, because Turkish economy is in trouble. And the Saudis, for the last 10 years, has been one of the biggest investors in Turkey, and they buy Turkish real estate. They're, I think, the number two buyers of Turkish real estate. So for Erdogan, he really needs the Saudi investments, and also the Saudis, they yield, they have influence over other some other Gulf countries. And Erdogan needs investment and financial help from those countries as well. So it's a very difficult decision to make for President Erdogan.
Yeah, real quick, Dr. Toll, I was in Istanbul a couple of weeks ago. The decline of the value of the lira and the financial crisis, also largely as a consequence of the souring of relations between the U.S. and Turkey, maybe not exclusively, it had a pretty profound impact. What's the status now? We have about 30 seconds left.
Well, he really needs to carry out structural reforms, but President Erdogan is not willing to do that. And I think the number one problem facing Turkey's economy is the fact that there is no independent judiciary, there is no rule of law. And I think the Turkish government has not taken the right steps on that. And you could tell, if you look at the value of lira against the dollar, you can tell the investors are not really confident in the newly released economic policy of the government.
Okay, we will end it there. We are out of time. We were joined from Washington by Dr. Gonu Tol, the founding director of the Middle East Institute Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor and has taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Syrian rebels appear to be complying with an agreement with Turkey and Russia to withdraw heavy weapons from Idlib and the buffer zone along the Turkish border. The Free Syrian Army already has confirmed that it has withdrawn all tanks and heavy guns from Idlib, the last rebel-held bastion in Syria. We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Welcome back, Rick.
Hi, guys.
Rick, this agreement seems to actually be working in its early stages here. I wanted to ask you first, though, where does this leave al-Qaeda, the Nusra Front, or any of the al-Qaeda-related organizations?
Well, Jabhat al-Nusra, or as they're known now, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the other groups like the Turkestan Islamic Party, they are not party to the agreement. They have not withdrawn their forces. And frankly, I think the media reports have exaggerated what's going on there. I think they're preparing the ground for if or when conflict resumes, they want to be laying the blame at the feet of the Syrian government. So I think the withdrawal, which has been prominently featured and which was promoted, it was basically a Turkish media relations effort. They took journalists into a select location and showed some heavy military equipment being moved. I think that was mostly a media stunt, to be honest.
I wanted to ask as well, the Russians are trying to take baby steps in implementing this agreement. The Russians want this to be very well-planned, well-organized, phased agreement. The Turks are a little bit more nervous, I think, because they have to expect the worst. They've already seen what a refugee crisis can do to the country and to the economy. Do you think that there's any daylight between the Russians and the Turks on the issue?
Yeah, they've got fundamentally different positions. Turkey's been a supporter of the attacks on the Damascus government from the very start. In fact, they set up refugee camps in Turkey before the conflict burst out, indicating they knew it was going to happen even before it officially happened. On the contrary, Russia is an ally of Damascus and has provided a steadily increasing amount of support. Of course, in August 2015 or September of 2015, they brought their own air force in to support the Syrians. And then most recently, they supplied the sophisticated S-300, anti-aircraft systems. So they've got very different positions, but the Russians are being as diplomatic as possible. They do not want to showdown with the U.S. and Turkey, of course, being a member of NATO. They're doing everything they can to avoid the conflict worsening. And Erdogan and Turkey are manipulating the situation for their own opportunistic reasons.
What do you think the real attitude is of the Assad government towards the Turkish Russian agreement in Idlib. Idlib is an important part of Syria. Syrian government is the sovereign there, but they weren't party to the agreement. Do you think they look at it favorably? Do they look at it as, hey, Russia is our indispensable ally. We can't stop Russia from doing something we would prefer them not to do? Or on the contrary, do they believe that this is actually an incremental step-by-step way to end the conflict in Idlib such that the Syrian government will ultimately someday regain control?
Well, the Syrian president, as I saw just a couple of days ago, made a statement saying that the agreement in Idlib was a temporary ceasefire. So and he went on to say that they intend to reclaim all of Syrian territory, which of course is in keeping with international law and which is brought up in all those resolutions at the United Nations Security Council. The Russians make a point of including that. In effect, I think the Syrians they need their big brother. They need Russian support. They're not in a position to sabotage or to reject agreements that Russia comes to. So far, it's the way that they've both worked together in reclaiming territory and minimizing the loss of life and kind of proceeding slowly and maximizing the reconciliation. That's worked well. The problem now is that you've had all of the terrorist groups who were in Aleppo, who were in Daraa, who were in Ghouta and other parts of Syria, they're all clustered in Idlib province. And so the problem is, where do they go? Who's going to take them? It's just come out that the UK is not accepting UK citizens who were part of the terrorist campaign, or in one case at least. So that's the dilemma. Now, hopefully this step-by-step process will be successful, and hopefully there's reports that of contention within the Al-Qaeda, the HTS group, or Jabhat al-Nusra, contention over whether to accept the agreement, the ceasefire. We'll have to see how that plays out. But there's a big push now claiming that the so-called rebels have agreed and have closely followed the agreement. I think it's being exaggerated, and there's still a real danger that conflict will erupt. In fact, the Syrian army is grouping north of Aleppo in case they decide or they feel they need to go in and remove the Al-Qaeda group, which has been launching periodic attacks into outer Aleppo. They've been launching mortars and other attacks into the outskirts of Aleppo. So the situation is still it's still fraught with danger.
Indeed. Rick Sterling is our guest. Rick is an investigative journalist. The rebels in Idlib, not only have they been shipped there from Ghouta or from Aleppo or from other parts of the country as they've lost military grounds. In each and every operation, at the end of the day, when they're kind of defeated, the Syrian government has said, okay, look, there's a way so that we can actually end the bloodshed in this city or that city. We'll let you get on buses with your families and you go to Idlib. So now we have like tens of thousands of armed combatants who are part of the myriad number of terrorist organizations grouped together in Idlib. I mean, when we're talking about heavy weapons, the ones that they say are being transferred out, we're talking about tanks. I mean, this shows that you can't be like an armed rebel group with tanks without, you know, phenomenal international state support.
Yep, that's exactly true. Phenomenal international support for the armed groups that have been attacking the Syrian government. It is phenomenal, and it's involved the heaviest of equipment. Just the other day, some Syrian heavy equipment was basically destroyed by an anti-tank missile fired from one of the militant groups in Idlib. So Turkey is playing it for all they can. The other element that's important to be aware of is it's not just these groups who the militants, the thousands of militants who left Aleppo and Deraa and other locations in Syria. You've also got foreign fighters such as the Uyghurs, who are a major component of the Turkish Turkestan Islamic Party. You've got this group, which Jabhat al-Nusra said was the spearhead of the huge attack into Idlib, which took place early in 2015. So there's tens of thousands of these militants there, and there's no country in the world that would accept to have a chunk of its territory dominated and controlled without challenge by armed terrorists.
Yeah, I think that's something that so many people don't understand. Hey, we've talked about this on the show, that Syria is a sovereign nation. It has invited one country to come into the country and to help it fight off these terrorist groups. And as Rick rightly points out, a myriad of terrorist groups. There's another country that's occupying, or a couple of countries that are occupying Syrian territory illegally. But, you know, this is the Syrian people's country, and they have a right to not have foreign forces and terrorists on their soil. It's as simple as that, really.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine, like, if we just put the shoe on the other foot, like if America had, because people didn't like the U.S. government, you know, foreign terrorist operatives from all over Northern Africa or Uyghur military forces from right. Western China,
right.
all gathered together and getting support, say, from Canada or Mexico, and then somehow thinking that that was a legitimate force because they had seized territory, and now there was going to be a peace agreement or a ceasefire agreement or a deconfliction agreement whereby they are allowed to just keep control over that territory. I mean, if Americans actually put the shoe
ludicrous.
On the other foot,
yeah,
would be completely unacceptable. 30 seconds left, Rick Sterling.
Well, we've got some critical deadlines coming up. One of in another week, all of the militants are supposed to be out of the demilitarized zone. That has not happened. So that's going to be a critical point, and we'll see what happens after that in the coming week, and after the 20th of October, we'll have to see whether the conflict erupts again in Syria.
That was the voice of Rick Sterling, who joined us from San Francisco. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And if you go there, you can catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to today. So we've got a lot.
We have a lot, but we're missing Nicole Roussel.
Yes, Nicole's
today. So I'm not even sure we should try to do funny headlines without Nicole. That's going to be, anyway.
Well, there are some disgusting ones and some misleading ones that we can certainly jump into.
This will be a test for all of us without Nicole. Go ahead, Steve. Where do you want to start?
Well, the first one is definitely in the disgusting category, and it's actually an RT headline, and it's the kind of story that was only covered by RT, not by so much by the Washington Post or the New York Times and so on, but it's a real story. And it's about Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, who is talking to some Serbian students in Serbia. And the headline reads, "We bombed you to save you. NATO head Stoltenberg speaks about 1999 bombings on visit to Serbia."
That was like when the U.S. was torching Vietnamese peasant villages. It was to save them from communists.
Yeah, it's the classic destroying the village in order to save it language. And he basically said that. "We did this in order to save you, killed hundreds or thousands of Serbian civilians, many thousands of Serbians, counting military, to quote unquote save the country." It's the fact that he's now bragging about it is kind of disgusting, to put it mildly.
And actually, if we go back, it was to destroy a country. There was a country. It wasn't Serbia was one of the republics of Yugoslavia, six republics. The unity of all Slavs had been a multinational republic. Then after World War II, in the victory of the partisans and Tito against the fascist occupiers, became a socialist country. It was the destruction of a country, and Yugoslavia no longer exists. You know, it's funny, John. I mean, this isn't funny, but remember how the mainstream media always says about Russia was the first country that used force of arms to change the borders of post-World War II Europe?
Yeah.
Right?
It's not true.
Yugoslavia. First of all, Kosovo was part of Serbia. It was as a consequence of the dropping of 28,000 bombs and missiles on Serbia between March 28th and June 3rd, 1999. Basically, Kosovo was taken over and made into a colonial project by NATO, but that led ultimately to, and pretty rapidly, to the dissolution, the ending of a country, Yugoslavia, and the changing of borders in Europe.
You know, I was serving in Athens at the time of that war, and Greece is an officially Orthodox Christian country. Serbia is an officially Orthodox Christian country, and there are great cultural and religious ties between the two countries. So being in Greece while Serbia was being bombed was like being in Serbia. I mean, there were attacks on the U.S. embassy, and every Greek that I encountered, whether it was a taxi driver or a guy at the dry cleaner, begged me as an American diplomat to try to talk sense into people in Washington to stop killing civilians.
Yeah, and they were. The U.S. was actually, remember when people in Belgrade, in Serbia, went, the young, especially young people, they put targets on their back.
Yes, I do remember.
And they got on the bridges because they were like, we're not going to let our bridges be bombed by NATO. And then young people in Athens, even young people in New York City, I was amongst them. I wasn't young, but I was amongst them, putting targets on their back and occupying the Brooklyn Bridge.
I'll tell you something that I've never told anybody. I think probably my ex-wife doesn't even know. But on my own time, one day while I was serving as an active duty CIA officer in Athens, I went to a concert that was a fundraiser held by the Communist Party of Greece, the KKE. The fundraiser was to benefit, quote unquote, the people of Serbia. While I was there, I ran into three of my sources, which was very, very awkward. And they all kind of looked at me funny. And I said, you know, I'm on my own time. I don't have to hide my politics. Oh, it's going to the communists. I said, it's going to the Serbians. I'm Orthodox too, you know. I think that this policy's wrong. We're killing all these innocent people for what? For nothing.
Yeah.
I did my small part.
Since we're on the radio, I think we'd have to remind people about one of the most egregious incidents, which wasn't the most people killed, but it was one of the most egregious, which was when NATO bombed Radio Television Serbia.
That's right.
And killed 16 employees on the grounds that they were broadcasting propaganda.
Right.
In their own country, their own TV station. Yeah. Then NATO also bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade.
In fact, it was early on in the conflict they bombed the Chinese.
Yeah.
And then had to apologize.
Well, we spent a long time on the Yugoslav war, actually, more than just one headline. We have 5 minutes left. Where do you want to go, Steve?
Let's go to the next headline, which I have in the disgusting category, but it could have also been in the funny category, depending on your sense of humor. Michelle, this is from USA Today. Michelle Obama, George W. Bush is my, quote, partner in crime, and, quote, I love him to death. I mean, this is a real eye roll of a story, but a real telling story as well. It's a real commentary on the state of politics and the ruling class in America, that Michelle Obama and George just loves George Bush to death.
It's a picture of Michelle Obama hugging Bush from the side, and Bush is kind of smiling. He looks almost like he's about to cry. And yeah, they're close buddies. You know, it reminds me of the pictures that we also saw for a long time, Bill and Hillary Clinton with Donald Trump and Melania Trump. They were all friends too. The Clintons were at the Trump wedding. Yeah, it is the ruling clique in America. They're actually friends. But what's more maybe noteworthy about this story is that George W. Bush now has the support of more than 50% of all Democrats, because he's been mildly critical of Donald Trump. He was a big supporter of Brett Kavanaugh. But as a consequence, because he's been mildly critical of Trump, 53% of Democrats now support, have a favorable opinion of George W. Bush, which is impossible to think about in one way. It was just 2009 during the inauguration of Obama. Bush left the presidency with a 22% approval rating.
We booed him at the inauguration.
3 million people stuck their middle finger up in the air as he was flying away in that helicopter. And now Democrats, 53%, think, yeah, George W. Bush is a good guy. 1 million Iraqis are dead. 5,000 Americans died in the war of aggression, Iraq, Bush's war. Another 40 or 50,000 had life-changing injuries. But yeah, we love him to death. Disgusting. Next headline.
Okay. Well, we're on to, again, something I put under funniest, but could be under disgusting as well. The end of the Saudi whisperer. Tom Friedman bet big on Mohammed bin Salman and lost. What can we learn from that? And there's an article in the Washington Post. So good old Tom Friedman and his love for Mohammed bin Salman. And now he's going to have to, now he's actually put out an article, you know, sort of retracting that and saying, well, maybe he shouldn't have been quite so, you know.
Oh, he was gushing. It was disgusting. But the thing is, though, Steve, when he first published his very first Mohammed bin Salman piece in The New York Times, it was when Mohammed bin Salman came here on that first official visit where he went. He met Oprah Winfrey and he met all these Hollywood people and
businessmen.
MIT. Harvard, yeah. So Friedman was just gushing in his praise of Mohammed bin Salman. And anybody in America who knows anything about Saudi Arabia, especially here in Washington, I still sort of operate in those circles, responded with, is he insane? I mean, was Friedman that easily tricked? But then if you go back through his career and look at many of his other op-eds, he's always wrong. Always.
And
he's terrible.
And also, Tom Friedman, you remember that article he penned in the middle of the war? He said, for the magic of McDonald's to work, we need the hidden glove of McDonnell Douglas.
Oh, yes.
Meaning, in other words, for American corporations to spread their influence in countries like Yugoslavia or countries that had previously been off limits for the United States, you need the military. You need the military-industrial complex. And, of course, the corporations do need the military-industrial complex. That says a lot about who Friedman really is.
Yeah. I do think we have to add, though, that Tom Friedman and the subject of Saudi Arabia is far from alone in terms of American journalists or politicians. For example, there was an article at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting a little while ago by Adam Johnson entitled David Ignatius is the foreign policy correspondent for The Washington Post. David Ignatius is 15 years of running spin for Saudi regime. And those two are hardly alone.
And Ignatius is the CIA's favorite journalist at the Washington Post.
I mean, you can't get a human rights record worse than Saudi Arabia.
Seriously, none worse. Well, we're out of time. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And if you go there, you can catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to. And there were a lot this time. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.